and extended it further southeast. It pointed directly at Ipswich. 12 miles from Ipswich, in a dense forest and close to the shore, was Bentwaters. He recalled from somewhere that they flew F-5s out of there, modern strike bombers with tactical nukes designed to halt an onslaught by 29,000 massed tanks. Behind him, the policeman's radio set crackled into life. The man walked over and answered the call. "There's a helicopter coming up from South," he said. "It's for me," said Preston. "Where do you want it to land?" "Is there a flat area nearby?" asked Preston. "Place we call the Meadows," said the patrolman. "Down Castle Street by the roundabout. Should be dry enough." "Tell him to go down there," said Preston. "I'll join him." He called to his team, some of whom were dozing in the cars. "Everybody in. We're going down to the Meadows." As they piled into the two cars, he took his map over to the patrolman. "Tell me, if you were here in Thetford and driving to Ipswich, which way would you go?" Without hesitation, the police motorcyclist pointed to a spot on the map. "I take the A1088 straight down to Ixworth, over the junction, and on down to cut into the A45 main road to Ipswich, here at Elmswell Village." Preston nodded. "So would I. Let's hope Chummy thinks the same. I want you to stay here and try to trace any other garage tenant who might have seen the missing man's car. I need that registration number." The light Bell helicopter was waiting in the meadow by the roundabout. Preston climbed out, taking his personal radio with him. "Stay here," he told Harry Birkinshaw. "It's a long shot. He's probably miles away. He's got at least a 50-minute start. I'll go as far as Ipswich and see if I can spot anything. If not, it's down to that registration number. Someone may have seen it. If Thetford police trace anyone who did, I'll be up there." He ducked under the whirling rotors and climbed into the narrow cabin, produced his ID card to the pilot, and nodded to the traffic controller, who had squeezed into the back. "That was fast," he shouted to the pilot. "I was airborne already," the pilot shouted back. The helicopter lifted off and climbed away from Thetford. "Where do you want to go?" "Down the A1088. "Want to see the demo, eh?" "What demo?" The pilot looked at him as if he'd just arrived from Mars. The chopper, nose down, whirled southeast with the line of the A1088 to starboard so that Preston could see it. "The RAF Honington demo," the pilot said. "It's been in all the papers and on TV." Of course he had seen the news coverage of the projected demonstration against the base. He had spent 2 weeks watching television in Chesterfield. He had just not realized the base lay down the A1088 between Thetford and Ixworth. In 30 seconds, he could see the real thing. Away to his right, the morning sun glinted on the runways of the airbase. A giant American Galaxy transport was taxiing round the perimeter after landing. Outside the base's several gates were the black lines of Suffolk policemen, hundreds of them, standing back to the wire, facing the demonstrators. From the swelling crowd in front of the police cordon, a dark line of marchers, banners flapping and waving above their heads, ran back down the access lane to the A1088, debouched onto that road and ran southeast towards Ixworth Junction. Straight below him, he could look down at Little Fakenham Village, with Honington Village swimming into view. He could make out the barns of Honington Hall and the red brick of Malting Row across the road. Here the marchers were at the thickest as they swirled around the entrance to the narrow lane leading to the base. His heart gave a thump. Up the road from Honington Village Centre, there was a line of cars tailbacked for half a mile. All drivers who had not realised that road would be blocked for part of the early morning, or who had hoped to get through in time. There were over 100 vehicles. Further down, right in the heart of the marching column, he could see the glint of 2 or 3 car roofs, evidently drivers who had been allowed through just before the road was closed, but who had not made Ixworth Junction in time to avoid being trapped. There were some in Ixworth Thorpe Village Centre, and a couple parked near a small church further on. "I wonder," he whispered. Valery Petrovsky saw the policeman who had originally stopped him, strolling in his direction. The column thinned a bit. It was the tail end that was passing.
"Sorry it's taking so long, sir. Seems there were more of them than foreseen." Petrovsky shrugged amiably. "Can't be helped, officer. I was a fool to try it. Thought I'd get through in time. Yeah, there's quite a few motorists being caught by it all. Won't be long now. About 10 minutes for the marchers. Then there's a few big outside broadcast vans bringing up the tail. Soon as they're past, we'll open the road again. Across the fields in front of them, a police helicopter went past in a wide circle. In its open doorway, Piotrowski could see the traffic controller talking into his handset.
Harry, can you hear me? Come in, Harry, it's John.
Preston was sitting in the doorway of the chopper over Ixworth Thorpe, trying to raise Birkinshaw. The watcher's voice came back, scratchy and tinny from Thetford.
Harry here. Radio, John.
Harry, there's an anti-cruise demo going on down here. There's a chance, just a chance, that Chummy got caught up in it. Hold on. He turned to the pilot.
How long's that been going on? About an hour. When did they close the road at Ixworth down there?
From the rear, the traffic officer leaned forward.
5:20,
he said. Preston glanced at his watch. 6:25. Harry, get the hell down the A134 to Bury St. Edmunds. Pick up the A45 and meet me at the junction of the 1088 and the 45 at Elmswell. Use the copper up at the garages as an outrider. And Harry, tell Joe to drive like never in his life. He tapped the pilot on the shoulder.
Take me down to Elmswell and set me down in a field near the road junction.
By air, it was only 5 minutes. As they passed over Ixworth Junction, across the A143, Preston could see the long, snaking column of parked coaches on the verge, the ones that had brought the bulk of the marchers to this picturesque and sylvan part of the countryside. 2 minutes later, he could make out the big dual carriageway A45 running from Bury St. Edmunds to Ipswich. The pilot banked into a turn, looking for a landing spot. There were meadows near the point where the narrow lane-like A1088 debouched into the sweep of the A45.
They could be water meadows,
shouted the pilot.
I'll hover. You can jump from a couple of feet.
Preston nodded. He turned to the traffic controller, who was in uniform.
Grab your cap. You're coming with me. That's not my job,
protested the sergeant.
I'm traffic control. That's what I want you for. Come on, let's go.
He jumped the 2 feet from the step of the bell into the thick, long grass. The police sergeant, holding his flat cap against the draft of the rotors, followed him. The pilot lifted away and turned towards Ipswich and his base. With Preston in the lead, the pair plodded across the meadow, climbed the fence and dropped onto the A1088. 100 yards away, it joined the A45. Across the junction, they could see the unending stream of traffic heading towards Ipswich.
Now what? Asked the police sergeant.
Now you stand here on the road and stop cars coming south down this road. Ask the drivers if they have been on the road from as far north as Honington. If they join this road south of Ixworth Junction or at it, let them go. Tell me when you get the first one to have come through the demo. He walked down the A45 and looked right towards Bury St. Edmunds.
Come on, Harry, come on.
The cars coming south stopped for the police uniform in their path, but all averred they had joined the road south of the anti-nuclear demonstration. 20 minutes later, Preston saw the Thetford patrolman, siren wailing to clear a path, racing towards him, followed by the two watcher cars. They all screeched to a halt at the entrance of the A1088. The policeman raised his visor.
I hope you know what you're doing, sir. I don't reckon that journey's ever been done faster. There's going to be questions.
Preston thanked him and ordered both his cars a few yards up the narrow secondary road. He pointed to a grassy bank. Joe, ram it.
Do what?
Ram it! Not hard enough to wreck the car, just make it look good. The two Suffolk policemen stared in amazement as Joe rammed his car into the bank by the road. His rear end stuck out, blocking half the freeway. Preston pointed to the other car 15 yards further up.
Out! He ordered the driver. Come on, lads. All together now. On its side.
It took 7 shoves before the MI5 car rolled onto its side. Taking a rock from the hedgerow, Preston smashed a side window on Joe's car, scooping handfuls of the crystalline fragments and scattering them across the road.
Ginger, lie on the road, here, near Joe's car. Barney, get a blanket from the boot and put it over him.
Right over. Face and all, said Preston. Okay, the rest of you, over the hedge and stay out of sight.
Preston beckoned the two policemen to him. Sergeant, there's been a nasty pile-up. I want you to stand by the body and direct the traffic past it.
Officer, park your bike, walk up the road, and slow down oncoming traffic as it approaches.
The two policemen had had orders from Ipswich and Norwich, respectively, cooperate with the men from London, even if they were maniacs. Preston sat at the base of the bank, a handkerchief pressed to his face as if to staunch blood from a broken nose.
There's nothing like a body by the roadside to slow down drivers or cause them to stare through the side windows they crawl past. Preston had made sure Ginger's body was on the driver's side for cars coming south down the A1088. Major Valeri Pietrovsky was in the 17th car. Like the others before it, the modest family hatchback saloon slowed to the policeman's flapping hand, then crawled past the crash scene. On the grassy bank, eyes half closed, the memory of the photo in his pocket imprinted on the mind, Preston looked across at the Russian 12 feet away as the saloon swerved slowly between the two cars that almost blocked the road. From the side of his eye, he saw the small saloon turn left into the A45, pause for a break in the traffic, and pull into the Ipswich-bound stream. Then he was up and running. The two drivers and two watchers came back over the fence at his call. An amazed motorist who was just slowing down saw the body leap off the ground and help others to pull a crashed car back onto its four wheels, where it fell with a crunch. Joe climbed behind the wheel of his own car and backed it out of the bank. Barney wiped mud and grass off its headlights before climbing in. Harry Birkin Shaw took not one, but three strong mints and popped the lot. Preston approached the motorcycle patrolman. "You'd better get back to Thetford. Many thanks for all your help." To the sergeant on foot, he said, "I'm afraid I'll have to leave you here. Your uniform's too noticeable to come with us, but many thanks for your help." The two MI5 cars swept away towards the A45 and turned left to Ipswich. The uninvolved motorist who had seen it all asked the abandoned sergeant, "Are they making a film for the telly?"
"I shouldn't be at all bloody surprised," said the sergeant. "By the way, sir, can you give me a lift into Ipswich?"
The industrial and commuter traffic into Ipswich was dense and becoming thicker as they approached the town. It provided good cover for the two watcher cars, who constantly shifted position so they could alternately keep the Ford hatchback in view. They came into town past Whitton, but short of the town centre, the small saloon up ahead took a right into Chevalier Street and round the ring to the Hanford Bridge, where it crossed the River Orwell. South of the river, the quarry followed the Ranelagh Road and then took another right. "He's heading out of town again," said Joe, holding station 5 cars behind the quarry. They were entering Belstead Road, which leaves Ipswich, heading south. Quite suddenly, the hatchback pulled to the left and entered a small private housing estate. "Steady," Preston warned Joe. "You mustn't see us now." He told the second car to stay at the junction of the access road and Belstead in case the quarry came round in a circle and back out again. Joe cruised slowly into the complex of 7 cul-de-sac that make up the Hayes. They went past the entrance to Cherry Hayes Close just in time to see the man they were tailing parked on the hard pad in front of a small house halfway up the close. The man was climbing out of his car. Preston ordered Joe to keep going until out of sight, and stop. "Harry, give me your hat, and see if there's a conservative rosette in the glove pocket." There was, left over from the 2 weeks when the team had used it to enter and leave the Royston house by the front door without arousing suspicion. Preston pinned it to his jacket, stripped off the raincoat he had worn by the roadside where he had first seen Pietrovsky face to face, donned Harry's pork-pie hat, and climbed out. He walked into Cherry Hayes Close and strolled up the side opposite the house of the Soviet agent. Directly facing number 12 was number 9. It had a Social Democratic Party poster in the window. He walked to the front door and knocked. It was opened by a pretty young woman. From inside, Preston could hear a child's voice, then that of a man. It was 8 o'clock. The family was at breakfast. Preston raised his hat. "Good morning, madam." Seeing his rosette, the woman said, "Oh, I'm sorry, you're really wasting your time here. We vote SDP.
"I perfectly understand, ma'am, but I have a piece of promotional literature which I would be most grateful if you would show to your husband."
He handed her his plastic card, identifying him as an officer of MI5. She did not look at it, but sighed.
"Oh, very well. I'm sure it won't change anything."
She left him standing on the doorstep, withdrew into the house, and seconds later Preston heard a whispered conversation from the kitchen in the back. A man came out and walked down the hall, holding the card. A young business executive in dark trousers, white shirt, club tie. No jacket, that would come when he left for work. He held Preston's card and was frowning.
"What on earth's this?" he asked.
"What it seems to be, sir, is the identification card of an officer of MI5.
"It's not a joke?"
"No, it's perfectly genuine."
"I see. Well, what do you want?"
"Would you let me come in and close the door?" The young man paused for a moment, then nodded.
Preston doffed his hat again and stepped over the threshold. He closed the door behind him. Across the street, Valery Piotrowski was in his sitting room behind the opaque net curtains. He was tired. His muscles ached from the riding, and he helped himself to whiskey. Glancing through the curtains, he could see one of the seemingly endless political canvassers talking to the people at number 9. He had had 3 himself over the past 10 days, and another wad of party literature had been on his doormat when he arrived. He watched the householder allow the man into his hallway. Another convert, he thought. Fat lot of good it will do them. Preston sighed with relief. The young man watched him doubtfully. From behind, his wife stared from the kitchen door. The face of a small girl of about 3 appeared round the doorframe by her mother's knee.
"Are you really from MI5?" asked the man.
"Yes. We don't have 2 heads and green ears, you know." For the first time, the younger man smiled. "No, of course not. It's just a surprise. But what do you want with us?" "Nothing, of course," grinned Preston. "I don't even know who you are. My colleagues and I have tailed a man we believe to be a foreign agent, and he has gone into the house across the road. I would like to borrow your phone and perhaps allow a couple of men to observe the house from your upper bedroom window."
"Number 12?" asked the man. "Jim Ross? He's not a foreigner."
"We think he may be. Could I use the phone?"
"Well, yes, I suppose, sir."
He turned towards his family. "Come on, all back in the kitchen." Preston rang Charles Street and was put through to Sir Bernard Hemmings, who was still in Cork. Birkinshaw had already used the police radio net to inform Cork in guarded language that the client was at his home in Ipswich and that the taxis were in the neighbourhood and on call.
"Preston," said the Director-General down the line. "John, where are you exactly?"
"A small residential cul-de-sac called Cherry Hayes Close in Ipswich," said Preston. "We've run Chummy to earth. I'm certain this time it's his base."
"Do you think it's time we moved in?"
"Yes, sir, I do. I fear he may be armed. I think you know what I mean. I don't think it's one for the special branch or the local force." He told his DG what he wanted, then replaced the receiver and put in a private call to Sir Nigel in Sentinel House.
"Yes, John, I agree," said C, when he'd been given the same information.
"If he's got with him what we think, it had better be as you ask. The SAS."
Chapter 23. To call in the Special Air Service, Britain's elite and multi-role regiment of experts in deep penetration, observation, and occasionally urban assault, is not as easy as the more adventurous television dramas might suggest. The SAS never operates on its own initiative. Under the Constitution, it can, like any part of the armed forces, only operate inside the United Kingdom in support of the civil authority, that is, the police. Thus, ostensibly, the local police remain in overall command of the operation. In reality, once the SAS men have been given the go order, the local police are well advised to step smartly backwards. Under the law, it is the chief constable of a county in which an emergency has arisen, that the local police are deemed not to be able to handle unassisted, who must make a formal request to the Home Office for the SAS to be brought in. It may be the chief constable is advised to make the request, and he would be a bold man to refuse to do so if the advice came from high enough. When the chief constable has made his formal request to the permanent undersecretary at the Home Office, the latter will pass the request to his opposite number in defence, who in turn will apprise the director of military operations of the request, and the DMO will alert the SAS at their Hereford base camp. That the procedure can work within minutes is due in part to the fact that it has been rehearsed and honed to a fine art over and over again, and partly to the fact that the British establishment, when required to move fast, contains enough interpersonal relationships to permit a great level of procedure to be kept at verbal level, with the inevitable paperwork left to catch up later. British bureaucracy may appear slow and cumbersome to the British, but it is greased lightning compared with its European and American counterparts. Most British chief constables have in any case been to Hereford to meet the unit known simply as the regiment and to be shown exactly what kinds of assistance could be put at their disposal if requested. Few have emerged unimpressed.
That morning, the Chief Constable of Suffolk was told from London of the crisis that had been visited on him in the form of a suspected foreign agent, believed to be armed and perhaps with a bomb, holed up in Cherry Hayes Close, Ipswich. He contacted Sir Hubert Villiers in Whitehall, where his call was expected. Sir Hubert briefed his minister and his colleague, the Cabinet Secretary, who informed the Prime Minister. Downing Street's assent having been obtained, Sir Hubert passed the by now politically cleared request to Sir Peregrine Jones at Defence, who knew it all anyway because he had had a chat with Sir Martin Flannery. Within 60 minutes of the first contact between the Home Office and the head of the Suffolk Constabulary, the Director of Military Operations was talking on a scrambled line to the commanding officer of the SAS at Hereford. The fighting arm of the SAS is based on a module of four. Four men make up a patrol. Four patrols a troop, and four troops a squadron. They rotate through the various SAS commitments, Northern Ireland, the Middle East, jungle training, and special projects, apart from the continuing NATO tasks and the maintenance of one squadron on standby at Hereford. The commitments tend to last from 6 to 9 months, and that month it was B Squadron that was based at Hereford. As usual, there was one troop on half-hour standby and another on two-hour readiness. The four troops in each squadron are always the air troop, free-fallers, boat troop, marine-trained in canoes and sub-aqua expertise, mountain troop, climbers, and mobile troop, armed Land Rovers. When Brigadier Jeremy Cripps finished his call from London, it was to 7 troop, the free-fall parachute men of B Squadron, that the task fell of going to Ipswich. "What is your normal routine at this hour?" asked Preston of the householder, whose name was Mr. Adrian. The young executive had just finished a conversation with the Assistant Chief Constable Crime down at his office in Ipswich Police Headquarters on the corner of Civic Drive and Elm Street. If there had been any lingering doubt in Mr. Adrian's mind as to the authenticity of his unexpected guest of half an hour earlier, it had been dispelled. Preston had suggested Adrian make the call himself, and he was rightly convinced the Suffolk police was backing the MI5 officer in his sitting room. He had also been told the man across the street might be armed and dangerous, and that an arrest would have to be made later in the day. "Well, I drive to work at about 9:15, that's in 10 minutes. About 10, my wife Lucinda takes Samantha to play school. She usually does her shopping, picks up Samantha at midday, and returns home on foot. I get back from work about 6:30, by car, of course." "I'd like you to take a day off work," said Preston. "Ring your office now and say you're not well, but leave the house at the usual time. You will be met at the top of the road, where Belstead Road joins the access to the Hayes, by a police car. What about my wife and child?" "I'd like Mrs. Adrian to wait here until the usual hour, then leave with Samantha and shopping basket, walk up there and join you. Is there anywhere you can go for the day?" "There's my mother at Felixstowe," said Mrs. Adrian nervously. "Could you spend the day with her? Perhaps even tonight?" "What about our house?" "I assure you, Mr. Adrian, nothing will happen to it," said Preston optimistically. He might have added it would either be unharmed or vaporized if things went wrong. "I must ask you to let me and my colleague use it as an observation post for the man across the way. We will come and go via the back. We will do absolutely no damage." "What do you think, darling?" Mr. Adrian asked his wife. She nodded. "I just want to get Samantha out of here," she said. "In 1 hour, I promise you," said Preston. "Mr. Ross across there has been up all night, because we've been tailing him. He's probably asleep, and in any case no police move against the house will take place before the afternoon, maybe the early evening." "All right," said Adrian. "We'll do it." He made his call to the office to excuse himself for the day, and drove off at 9:15. From his upper bedroom window, Valery Petrovsky saw him go. The Russian was preparing to catch a few hours' sleep. There was nothing unusual going on in the road. Adrian always left for work at this hour. Preston noted there was waste ground behind No. 9. He called up Harry Birkinshaw and Barney, who came in through the back, nodded to an embarrassed Mrs. Adrian, and went up to the front bedroom to adopt again their profession in life. Watching. Ginger had found a patch of high ground 1/4 mile away, from which he could see both the estuary of the Orwell and the docks by its side, and the small housing estate spread out below. With glasses, he could monitor the rear of No. 12, Cherry Hayes Close. "It backs onto the rear garden of another house in Bracken Hayes," he told Preston on his radio.
No sign of movement in house or garden. All windows closed. That's odd in this weather. Keep watching, said Preston. I'll be here. If I have to go, Harry will take over. An hour later, Mrs. Adrian and her child walked calmly out of the house and away. In the town itself, another operation was moving up through the gears. The chief constable, who had risen through the uniform branch, had handed the details of the pending operation to the ACC crime, Chief Superintendent Peter Lowe. Lowe had two detectives at the town hall, who elicited from the rating department that the target house was owned by a certain Mr. Johnson, but that rating bills were to be sent to Oxborough's, the estate agents. A call to the agents explained that Mr. Johnson was away in Saudi Arabia, and the house was let to a Mr. James Duncan Ross. A second picture of Ross, alias Timothy Donnelly of the streets of Damascus, was telexed up to Ipswich and shown to Oxborough's, who identified the tenant. The Town Hall Housing Department also came up with the architects who had designed the estate called The Hayes, and from this partnership detailed floor plans were obtained for the property called Number 12. They were even more helpful. Other houses, identical in design to the last detail, had been built elsewhere in Ipswich, and one was found to be still standing empty. It would be useful for the SAS assault team. They would know the exact geography of the house when they went in. The other part of Peter Lowe's duties was to find a holding area for the SAS men when they arrived. A holding area has to be private, covered, and quickly available, with access for vehicles and telephone communication. An empty warehouse down on Eagle Wharf was traced, and the owner agreed to let the police borrow it for a training exercise. It had big sliding doors which could open to admit the vehicle convoy and close to keep out prying eyes. A floor area, ample enough to construct a replica of the house in the Hayes out of lumber and sacking screen walls, and a small glass-sided office to use as an ops room. Just before noon, an army scout helicopter swished into the far side of Ipswich Municipal Airport and disgorged three men. One was the CO of the SAS regiment, Brigadier Cripps. One was the ops officer, a staff major with the regiment, and the third was the team commander, Captain Julian Lyndhurst. They were all in plain clothes, carried grips with their uniforms inside, and were met by an unmarked police car which took them straight to the holding area, where the police were establishing their operational centre. Chief Superintendent Lowe briefed the three officers to the limit of his ability, which was to the limit of what he had been told by London. He had talked on the telephone to John Preston, but not yet met him. "There's John Preston, I understand," said Brigadier Cripps, "who is the field controller for MI5. Is he about?" "I believe he's still up at the observation post," said Lowe. "The house he's taken over opposite the target dwelling. I could call him and ask him to leave by the back and come to join us." "I wonder, sir," said Captain Lyndhurst to his CO, "whether I might not go up there right away. You give me a chance to have a first look at the stronghold, and I could come back with this Preston chap." "All right, since a car has to go up anyway," said the CO. The police pointed out the rear door of Number 9 to the captain 15 minutes later, up on the hillside across the estuary from Eagle Wharf. Still in civilian clothes, the 29-year-old captain walked across the rough ground, hopped over the garden fence, and in through the back door. He met Barney in the kitchen, where he was brewing a cup of tea on Mrs. Adrian's stove. "Lyndhurst," said the officer, "from the regiment. Is Mr. Preston here?"
"John!"
Barney called up the stairs in a hoarse whisper, as the house was supposed to be empty.
"Brownjob here to see you."
Lyndhurst mounted to the front bedroom, where he found John Preston and introduced himself. Harry Birkinshaw muttered something about a cup of tea and left. The captain stared across the road at Number 12.
"There still seem to be some gaps in our information," drawled Lyndhurst. "Who exactly do you think is in there?"
"I believe it's a Soviet agent," said Preston. "An illegal, living here under the cover of James Duncan Ross. Mid-30s, medium height and build, probably very fit, a top pro." He handed Lyndhurst the photograph taken on the Damascus street. The captain studied it with interest.
"Anyone else in there?"
"Possibly, we don't know. Ross himself, certainly. He might have a helper. We can't talk to the neighbours. In this kind of area, we could never stop them gawping.
The people who live here said before they left they were sure he was living alone, but we can't prove that. And according to our briefing, you think he's armed? Maybe dangerous. A bit too much for the local lads, even with handguns, hmm?
Yes, I believe he has a bomb in there with him. He would have to be stopped before he can get to it.
Bomb, eh?
Said Lyndhurst with apparent lack of interest. He had done 2 tours in Northern Ireland.
Big enough to make a mess of the house or the entire street?
A bit bigger than that, said Preston. If we're right, it's a small nuke. The tall officer turned his entire gaze from the house across the street, and his pale blue eyes held Preston's.
Bloody hell, he said. I'm impressed.
Well, that's a plus, said Preston. By the way, I want him, and I want him alive.
Let's go back to the docks and talk to the CO, said Lyndhurst.
While Lyndhurst had been at Cherry Hayes Close, 2 other helicopters had arrived at the airport from Hereford, a Puma and a Chinook. The first bore the assault team, the second their numerous and arcane pieces of equipment. The team was under the temporary leadership of the deputy team commander, a veteran staff sergeant called Steve Bilbo. He was short, dark and wiry, tough as old boot leather, with bright black button eyes and a ready grin. Like all the senior NCOs in the regiment, he had been with them a long time, in his case 15 years. The SAS is unusual in this sense also. The officers are almost all in temporary attachment from their parent regiments, staying usually 2 to 3 years before returning to their parent units. Only the other ranks stay with the SAS, and not all of them, just the best. Even the commanding officer, though he will probably have served with the regiment before in his career, serves a short term as CO. Very few officers are long-stay men, and they are all in logistics, supply, technical posts in SAS Group HQ. Steve Bilbo had entered as a trooper from the parachute regiment, done his tour, been selected on merit for extension of attachment, and had risen to staff sergeant. He had done 2 fighting tours in Dhofar, sweated through the jungles of Belize, frozen through the countless nights in ambush and South Armagh, and relaxed in the Cameron Highlands of Malaya. He had helped train the West German GSG-9 teams and worked with Charlie Beckworth's Delta Group in America. In his time, he had known the boredom of the endless repetitiveness of the training that brought the men of the SAS to the ultimate peak of fitness and preparation, and the high adrenaline operations, racing under rebel fire for the shelter of a sangar in the hills of Oman, running a covert snatch squad against Republican gunmen in East Belfast, and doing 500 parachute jumps, most of them halo jobs, high altitude, low opening. To his chagrin, he had been one of the standby team when colleagues stormed the Iranian embassy in London in 1980, and he had not been called on. The rest of the team comprised 1 photographer, 3 intelligence collators, 8 snipers, and 9 assaulters. Steve hoped and prayed he would lead the assault team. Several unmarked police vans had met them at the airport and brought them to the holding area. When Preston and Lyndhurst arrived back at the warehouse, the team had arrived and were spreading their gear over the floor before the bemused gaze of several Ipswich policemen.
"Hello, Steve," said Captain Lyndhurst.
"Everything okay?"
"Hello, boss. Yes, fine. Just getting sorted."
"I've seen the stronghold. It's a small private house. 1 occupant known, maybe 2, and a bomb. It'll be a small assault, no room for more. I like you first in."
"Try and stop me, boss," Bilbo grinned. The accent in the SAS is on self-discipline rather than the externally applied kind. Any man who cannot produce the self-discipline needed to go through what the SAS men must do will not be there for long anyway. Those who can do not need rigid formality in personal relationships, such as are proper in a line regiment.
Thus, officers habitually address those they command, apart from each other, by first names. Other ranks tend to address their commissioned officers as boss, although the CO gets a sir. Between each other, SAS troopers refer to an officer as a Rupert. Staff Sergeant Bilbo caught sight of Preston, and his face lit up in a delighted grin.
"Major Preston! Good heavens, it's been a long time."
Preston stuck out a hand and smiled back. The last time he had seen Steve Bilbo was when, in the aftermath of the shootout in the bogside, he
He had taken refuge in a safe house where four SAS men under Bilbo's command had been running a covert snatch squad. Apart from that, they were both ex-paras, which always forms a bond. "I'm with Five now," said Preston. "Field controller for this op, at least from Five's end." "What have you got for us?" asked Steve. "Russian, KGB agent, top pro. Probably done the Spetsnaz course, so he'll be good, fast, and probably armed." "Lovely. Spetsnaz, eh? I'll see how good they really are." All three present knew of the Spetsnaz troops, the crack Russian elite saboteurs, Soviet equivalent of the SAS.
"Sorry to break up the party, but let's get the briefing underway," said Lyndhurst.
He and Preston mounted the stairs to the upper office, where they met Brigadier Cripps, the Ops Major, the ACC Crime, Chief Superintendent Lowe, and the SAS Intelligence Collators. Preston spent an hour giving as thorough a briefing as he could, and the atmosphere grew extremely grave. "Have you any proof there's a nuclear device in there?" asked the ACC at length. "No, sir. We intercepted a component in Glasgow designed for delivery to someone working undercover in this country. The backroom boys say it could have no other use in this world. We know the man in that house is a Soviet illegal. He was made on the streets of Damascus by the Mossad. His association with the secret transmitter in Chesterfield confirms what he is, so I am left with deductions. Unless the component taken in Glasgow was for the construction of a small device inside Britain, then what the hell was it for? On that, I come up with no other feasible explanation. As to Ross, unless there are two major covert operations being mounted in Britain by the KGB, that component was destined for him. QED. "Yes," said Brigadier Cripps. "I think we have to go with it. We have to assume it's there. If it's not, we'll have to talk to friend Ross rather earnestly." Chief Superintendent Lowe was having a private nightmare. He had to accept there was no other way but storming the house. What he was trying to envisage was the state of Ipswich if the device went off. "Couldn't we evacuate?" he asked with little hope. "He'd notice," said Preston flatly. "I think if he knows he's ruined, he'll take us all with him." The soldiers nodded. They knew that, deep inside Soviet Russia, they would have to do the same. The lunch hour was gone, and no one had noticed. Food would have been superfluous. The afternoon was spent in reconnaissance and preparation. Steve Bilbo went back to the airport with a photographer and a policeman. The three took the scout in one single run down the estuary of the Orwell, well away from the estate known as the Hayes, but on a track from which they could keep it in vision. The policeman pointed out the house. The photographer ran off 50 stills, while Steve took a long pan shot on video for screening in the holding area. The entire assault team, still in civilian clothes, went with the police to see the replica house built by the same architects to the same plans. By the time they got back to the holding area, they could see the stronghold on video and in close-up still pictures. They spent the rest of the afternoon inside the warehouse, practicing with the replica that the policeman had helped build under SAS supervision on the floor. It was only timber beams and sacking, but its dimensions were perfect, and showed up one overriding factor. Space inside the house was very limited. A narrow front door, narrow hall, cramped stairway and small rooms. Captain Lyndhurst decided to use only 6 assaulters, to the eternal grief of the 4 who were left out. There would also be 3 snipers, 2 in the Adrian's upper front bedroom and 1 on the hill overlooking the back gardens. The back of number 12 Cherry Hayes Close would be covered by 2 of Lyndhurst's 6 assaulters. They would be in full gear, but their combat suits would be covered by civilian Macintoshes. They would be driven in an unmarked police car to Brackenhayes Close. Here they would disembark, and without asking permission of the householder, would walk through the front garden of the house, backing onto the stronghold, down the side passage between house and garage, and into the back garden. Here they would strip off the raincoats, hop over the garden fence, and take up position in the back garden of the stronghold. "There may be a tripwire of fishing line across the garden," warned Lyndhurst, "but probably close to the rear of the house itself. Stand well back. On the signal, I want 1 stun grenade straight through the window of the rear bedroom and another through the kitchen window. Then unclip the HKs and hold position. Do not fire into the house. Steve and the lads will be coming up front." The rear access men nodded. Captain Lyndhurst knew that he would not be in the assault. Formerly a lieutenant in the Queen's Dragoon Guards, he was on his first tour with the SAS and had captain's rank because the SAS have no officers under that rank. He would revert to lieutenant on return to his parent regiment in a year, though he hoped to come back to the SAS later as a squadron commander. He also knew the tradition of the SAS, which is at variance with the convention for the rest of the army. Officers participate in combat in desert or jungle, but never in an urban environment. Only NCOs and troopers carry out assaults. The main attack, Lyndhurst had agreed with his CO and the ops officer, would be via the front. A van would draw up quietly, and four assaulters would step out. Two would take the front door, one with the wingmaster, the other with a 7-pound sledgehammer and or bolt cutters if necessary. The instant the door came down, the assault front rank would go in, Steve Bilbo and a corporal. The door squad would drop their wingmaster and hammer, rip their HKs off their chests, and enter the hallway as backup to the first pair. On entering the hallway, Steve would step straight past the stairs to the door of the sitting room on his left. The corporal would race up the stairs to take the front bedroom. Of the backup men, ex-door squad, one would follow the corporal up the stairs in case Chummy was in the bathroom, the other would follow Steve into the sitting room. The signal for the two men in the back garden to hurl their stun grenades into the two rear rooms, kitchen and back bedroom, would be the crash of the wingmaster at the front. By the time entry had been made, therefore, anyone in the kitchen or back bedroom would be reeling around, wondering what had hit him. Preston, who had volunteered to return to the observation post, was allowed to listen to the details of the assault. He already knew that the SAS was the only regiment in the British Army allowed to choose its weaponry from a worldwide menu. For close assault, they had chosen the German Hackler & Koch short-barreled 9mm rapid-fire submachine gun, light, easy to handle, and very reliable, with an up-and-over folding stock. The HK they habitually wore slantwise across the chest, held in place by two spring clips, loaded and cocked. This left their arms free for door opening, entering through windows, or throwing stun grenades. Once that was done, a single jerk brought the HK off the chest and into operation in less than half a second. For the taking of doors, practice had shown it was faster to blast off both hinges rather than take the lock. For this, they favoured the Remington Wingmaster pump-action repeater shotgun, but with solid heads in the cartridges rather than buckshot. Apart from these playthings, one of the door squad would need a hammer and bolt cutters in case the door, having lost its hinges, was held at the other side by several bolts and a chain. They also carried stun grenades, designed to blind temporarily by their flash and deafen by their crack, but not to kill. Lastly, each man would have his 13-shot 9mm Browning automatic on his hip. In the assault, Lyndhurst stressed, timing was of the essence. For the hour of the attack, he had chosen 9:45 p.m., when dusk would be deep in the close and therefore confusing, but not yet darkest night. He himself would be in the Adrian's house across the road, watching the target house and in contact with the approaching van bearing his assaulters by radio. If there was any pedestrian moving down the close at 9:44, he could tell the van driver to hold until they had cleared the door of the stronghold to be assaulted. Thus he could monitor the approach of the team. The police car bringing the two rear garden men to position would also be on that wavelength, and would drop those two men 90 seconds before the front door came down. He had one last refinement. As the van cruised up the close, he would ring Ross from the Adrian's phone across the road. He already knew the telephone in all these houses was on a small table in the hallway. The ploy was to distance the Soviet agent from his bomb, wherever it was, and give the assaulters the chance of a fast shot. Firing, as usual, would be the formula of two fast bursts of two shots each. Although the HK can empty its 30-round magazine in a couple of seconds, the SAS are accurate enough, even in the confused conditions of a terrorist hostage situation, to limit their firing to two-shot bursts, with one repeat. Anyone stopping those four rounds will speedily feel very unwell. Such economy also keeps the hostage alive. Immediately after the operation, the police would move into the close in strength to calm down the inevitable crowd that would come pouring out of the adjacent houses. A police cordon would be thrown right round the front of the house, while the assaulters left through the rear to cross the gardens and board their van, by then waiting in bracken haze close. As for the interior of the stronghold, the civil authority would take over there as well. A team of six from Aldermaston was due in Ipswich that evening by tea time. At six, Preston left the holding area and returned to the observation post, the Adrian's house, which he entered by the rear, unobserved. "Lights have just come on," said Harry Birkinshaw when Preston joined him in the front bedroom. Preston could see the sitting-room curtains of the house opposite were drawn, but there was a glow behind them, and a reflected glow through the panels of the front door.
"I think I saw movement behind the neck curtains in the upstairs bedroom just after she left," said Barney. "But he didn't put the light on. Well, he wouldn't. It was just after lunch. Anyway, he hasn't come out."
Preston called up Ginger on his hillside, but the story was the same. No movement at the back, either. "It'll start getting dusk in a couple of hours," Ginger told him over the radio. "Vision will deteriorate after that." Valery Petrovsky had slept fitfully and not well. Just before 1 o'clock, he awoke fully, propped himself up and stared across his bedroom, through the net curtains of the house across the way. After 10 minutes, he hauled himself off the bed, went to the bathroom and showered. He made a snack lunch in the kitchen at 2, and ate it at the kitchen table, occasionally glancing into the back garden, where a fine and invisible fishing line ran across the garden from side to side, round a small pulley attached by night to the garden fence and his back door. It was fixed round the bottom of a column of empty tin cans. He slackened the tension when he was out of the house and tightened it when he was at home. No one had yet brought the tins clattering down. The afternoon wore on, not unnaturally, considering what sat, armed and primed, in his sitting-room. He was tense, all his senses at full alert. He tried to read, but could not concentrate. Moscow must have had his message for 12 hours by now. He listened to some radio music, then at 6 settled in the sitting-room. Although he could see the bright summer evening on the faces of the houses opposite, his own house faced east, so it was now in shadow. The dark would deepen in his sitting-room from now on. He drew the curtains, as ever, before putting on the reading lamps, then, for want of anything better to do, switched on the television. As usual, it was dominated by the election campaign. In the holding area warehouse, the tension was mounting. Last preparations were being made to the assaulter's van, a plain grey Volkswagen with sliding side doors. 2 unused assailants in plain clothes would be in the front, one driving and the other on the radio to Captain Lyndhurst. They checked those radios over and over again, as with every other piece of equipment. The van would be led to the entrance to the Hayes by a plain police car. The driver of the van had memorized the layout of the Hayes and knew where to find Cherry Hayes Close. As they entered the Hayes, they would come under radio control of the captain in his window seat. The rear of the van had been lined with polystyrene foam sheeting to prevent the clink of metal on metal. The assault team was dressing and tooling up. Each man, over his underwear, pulled on the standard one-piece black boiler suit of fire-resistant fabric. At the last moment, this would be complemented by a treated black fabric balaclava hood. After that came the body armour, lightweight knitted Kevlar by Bristol Armour, designed to absorb a bullet's impact by spreading it outwards and sideways from the point of penetration. Behind the Kevlar, the men stuffed the ceramic trauma pads to complete the job of blunting the onrushing projectiles even further. Over all this went the harness to hold the assault weapon, the HK, and the grenades and handgun. On their feet they wore the traditional desert boots, ankle-high with thick rubber soles known as boots des, and whose colour can only be described as dirty. Captain Lyndhurst had a last word with each man, and the longest with his number 2, Steve Bilbo. There was, of course, no mention of good luck, anything else, but never good luck. Then the commander left for the observation post. He entered the Adrian's house just after 8. Preston could feel the tension emanating from the man. At 8:30 the phone rang. Barney was in the hall, so he took it. There had been several that day. Preston had decided it would be fruitless not to answer. Someone might call round to the house. Each time the caller had been told the Adrians were at her mother's for the day, and that the speaker was one of the team of painters redoing the sitting room. No caller had refused to accept this explanation. When Barney lifted the receiver, Captain Lyndhurst was coming out of the kitchen with a cup of tea. "It's for you," he said, and went back upstairs. From 9 onwards, the tension rose steadily. Lyndhurst spent much time on the radio to the holding area, from which, at 9:15, the grey van and its police car Shepherd left for the Hayes. At 9:33, the two vehicles had reached the access on Belstead Road, 200 yards from the target. They had to pause and wait. At 9:41, Mr. Armitage came out to leave 4 bottles for the milkman. Infuriatingly, he paused to inspect, in the gathering gloom, his stone bowl of flowers in the centre of his front lawn. Then he greeted a neighbour across the road.
"Go back in, you old fool," whispered Lyndhurst, standing in the sitting room and gazing across the road at the lights behind the curtains of the stronghold.
At 9:42, the plain police car with the 2 rear garden men was in position in Brackenhaze and waiting. 10 seconds later, Mr. Armitage called good night to his neighbour and went back inside. At 9:43, the grey van entered the close called Gorsehaze, the access road to the whole complex. Standing in the hall by the telephone, Preston could hear the chit-chat between the van driver and Lyndhurst. The van was cruising slowly and quietly towards the entrance to Cherryhaze. There was still no pedestrian on the road. Lyndhurst ordered the 2 rear garden men to quit their police car and start moving. "Entering Cherryhaze, 15 seconds, muttered the van's co-driver.
"Slow down. 30 seconds to go," replied Lyndhurst.
20 seconds later, he said,
"Enter the close now."
Round the corner came the van, quite slowly, on sidelights.
8 seconds, murmured Lyndhurst into the receiver, then a savage whisper to Preston.
"Dial now."
The van cruised up the close, past the door of number 12, and stopped in front of Mr. Armitage's bowl of flowers. It was deliberate. The assaulters wanted to approach the stronghold slantwise. The oiled side door slid back, and into the gloom 4 men in black stepped in complete silence. There was no running, no pounding of feet or hoarse cries. In rehearsed order, they walked calmly across Mr. Armitage's lawn, round the parked hatchback of Mr. Ross, and up to the front door of number 12. The man with the wingmaster knew which side the hinges would be. Before he had finished walking, his gun was at the shoulder. He made out the hinge positions and took careful aim. Beside him, another figure waited with a sledgehammer swung back. Behind them were Steve and the corporal. HK's ready. In his sitting room, Major Valeri Piotrowski was unquiet. He could not concentrate on the television. His senses picked up too much. The clatter of a man putting out milk bottles, the meow of a cat, the snarl of a motorcycle engine far away, the hoot of a freighter entering the estuary of the Orwell across the valley. 9:30 had produced another current affairs program, with yet more interviews with ministers and hopeful ministers-to-be. In exasperation, he flicked over to BBC Two, only to find a documentary about birds. He sighed. It was better than politics. It had hardly been on 10 minutes when he heard Armitage next door putting out his empty milk bottles. Always the same number and always the same time of night, he thought. Then the old fool was calling to someone across the street. Something on the television caught his eye, and he stared in amazement. The interviewer was talking to a lanky man in a flat cap about his passion, which appeared to be pigeons. He was holding one up in front of the camera, a sleek creature with a distinctive cast to its beak and head. Piotrowski sat bolt upright, concentrating on the bird with almost all of his attention, listening to the interview with the rest. He was sure the bird was identical to one he had seen somewhere before. "Is this lovely bird for showing in the competition?" the girl interviewer was asking. She was new, a bit too bright, trying to squeeze more from the interview than it merited.
"Good Lord, no," said the flat-cap man. "This isn't a fancy. It's a waistcoat."
There was a bright flash of recall. Piotrowski saw again the room and the guest suite of the General Secretary's dacha at Usova.
"Found him in the street last winter,"
the wizened old Englishman had said, and the bird had gazed out of its cage with bright, clever eyes.
"Well, it's not the sort we would see about the town," suggested the girl on the television. She was floundering.
At that moment, the telephone in Piotrowski's hallway rang. Normally, he would have gone to answer it, in case it was a neighbour. To pretend to be out would have been suspicious with the house lights on, and he would not have taken his handgun to the hall, but he stayed and stared at the screen. The phone rang on insistently. With the television, it drowned the soft pad of rubber-soled feet on the pavement.
"I should hope not," replied the flat-cap man cheerfully. "A Westcote ain't a streety neither. It's probably one of the finest strains of racer there is. This little beauty will always speed back to the loft where it was raised. That's why they're more commonly known as homers." Piotrowski came out of his chair with a snarl of rage. The big precision-made Sako target pistol that he had kept close to him since he had entered Britain came up with him from its place down the side of the seat cushion. He uttered one short word in Russian. No one heard him, but the word was traitor. At that moment, there was a roar. Then another, so close together they were almost one. With them came the shatter of glass from his front door, two huge bangs from the rear of the house, and the thud of feet in the hall. Piotrowski spun towards the sitting-room door and fired three times. His Sako Tri-Ace, made to take three interchangeable barrels, had the heaviest caliber of the three fitted. It also packed five rounds in its magazine. He kept to three. He might need the other two for himself. But the three he fired slammed through the flimsy woodwork of the closed door into the hall beyond. The citizens of Cherry Hayes Close will describe that night for the rest of their lives, but none will ever get it quite right. The roar of the wingmaster catapulted them all out of their chairs as it tore the two hinges off the door. The moment he had fired, the gunman stepped sideways and back to give room to his mate. One swing of the sledge and the lock, bolt and chain at the other side flew in all directions. Then he, too, stepped sideways and back. Both men dropped their weapons and flicked their HKs forward and out. Steve and the corporal had already gone through the gap. The corporal took three bounds to get up the stairs, the sledgehammer man on his heels. Steve ran past the ringing telephone, reached the sitting room, turned to face it, and was lifted off his feet. The three slugs that ripped across the hallway hit him with an audible whap and blew him against the stairs. The wingmaster man simply leaned across the still-closed door and fired two-round bursts. Then he kicked the door open and went in on the roll, coming to his feet at the crouch well inside the room. When the shotgun fired, Captain Lyndhurst opened the front door across the road and watched, Preston behind him. In the lighted hallway, the captain saw his deputy team commander approach the sitting-room door, only to be thrown aside like a rag doll. Lyndhurst started to walk forward, Preston behind him. As the trooper who had fired the two bursts came to his feet and surveyed the inert figure on the carpet, Captain Lyndhurst appeared in the doorway. He took in the scene at a glance, despite the drifting plume of cordite smoke. "Go and help Stephen Hall," he said crisply. The trooper did not argue. The man on the floor began to move. Lyndhurst drew his Browning from beneath his jacket. The trooper had been good. Piotrowski had taken one slug in the left knee, one in the lower stomach, and one in the right shoulder. His pistol had been flung across the room. Despite the distortion caused by the woodwork, the trooper had connected with three out of the four slugs. Piotrowski was in hideous pain, but he was alive. He began to crawl. 12 feet away, he could see the grey steel, the flat box on its side, the two buttons, one yellow and one red. Captain Lyndhurst took careful aim and fired once. John Preston ran past him so fast he jostled the officer's hip as he ran. He went on his knees beside the body on the floor. It was on its side, half the back of the head blown away, the mouth still working like a fish on a slab. Preston bent his head to the dying face. Lyndhurst still had his gun at the aim, but the MI5 man was between him and the Russian. He stepped to one side to get a clearer shot, then lowered the Browning. Preston was rising. There was no need for a second shot.
"We'd better get the Wallows from Aldermaston to have a look at that," said Lyndhurst, gesturing at the steel cabinet in the corner.
"I wanted him alive," said Preston.
"Sorry, old boy."
"Couldn't be done," said the captain. At that moment, both men jumped at the sound of a loud click and a voice speaking to them from the sideboard. They saw the sound came from a large radio set, which had switched itself on with a timer device. The voice said,
"Good evening. This is the Radio Moscow, the English language service, and here is the 10 o'clock news. In Tehran, today, the government stated..."
Captain Lyndhurst stepped over and switched the machine off. The man on the floor stared at the moquette carpet with sightless eyes.
immune to the coded message, meant for him alone.
Chapter 24. The lunch invitation was for 1 o'clock on Friday the 19th of June at Brooks Club in St. James. Preston entered the portals at that hour, but even before he could announce himself to the club porter in the booth to his right, Sir Nigel was striding down the marbled hall to meet him. "My dear John, how kind of you to come." They adjourned to the bar for a pre-lunch drink, where the conversation was informal. Preston was able to tell the chief that he had just returned from Hereford, where he had visited Steve Bilbo in hospital. The staff sergeant had had a lucky escape. Only when the flattened slugs from the Russian's gun were removed from his body armour did one of the doctors notice a sticky smear and have it analysed. The cyanide compound had failed to enter the bloodstream. The SAS man had been saved by the trauma pads. Otherwise, he was heavily bruised, slightly dented, but in good shape.
"Excellent," said Sir Nigel with genuine enthusiasm. "One does so hate to lose a good man."
For the rest, most of the bar was discussing the election result, and many of those present had been up half the night waiting for the last results in the close-fought contest to come in from the provinces. At 1:30 the hour, they went in to lunch. Sir Nigel had a corner table where they could talk in privacy. On the way in, they passed the Cabinet Secretary, Sir Martin Flannery, coming the other way. Although they all knew each other, Sir Martin saw at once that his colleague was in conference. The Mandarins acknowledged each other's presence with an imperceptible inclination of the head, sufficient for two scholars of Oxford. Backslapping is best left to foreigners.
"I really asked you here, John," said C, as he spread his linen napkin over his knees, "to offer you my thanks and my congratulations. A remarkable operation and an excellent result. I suggest the rack of lamb, quite delicious at this time of year."
"As to the congratulations, sir, I fear I can hardly accept them," said Preston quietly. Sir Nigel studied the menu through his half-moon glasses.
"Indeed? Are you being admirably modest, or not so admirably discourteous? Ah, beans, carrots, and perhaps a roast potato, my dear."
"Simply realistic, I hope," said Preston when the waitress departed. "Might we discuss the man we knew as Franz Winkler, whom you so brilliantly tailed to Chesterfield? Permit me to be frank, Sir Nigel. Winkler could not have shaken off a headache with a box of aspirins. He was an incompetent and a fool. I believe he almost lost you all at Chesterfield Railway Station." "A fluke," said Preston. "With a bigger watcher operation, we'd have had men at each stop along the line. The point is, his manoeuvres were clumsy. They told us he was a pro, and a bad one at that, yet failed to shake us."
"I see. What about Winkler?" "Ah, lamb. And cooked to perfection."
They waited until they were served, and the waitress was gone. Preston picked at his food, troubled. Sir Nigel ate with enjoyment. Franz Winkler came into Heathrow with a genuine Austrian passport, containing a valid British visa.
"So he did, to be sure.
And we both know, as did the immigration officer, that Austrian citizens do not need a visa to enter Britain. Any consular officer of ours in Vienna would have told Winkler that. It was the visa that prompted the passport control officer at Heathrow to run the passport number through the computer, and it turned out to be false."
"We all make mistakes," murmured Sir Nigel.
"The KGB does not make that kind of mistake, sir. Their documentation is accurate to the point of brilliant.
Don't overestimate them, John. All large organisations occasionally make a balls up. More carrots, no? Then, if I may..."
"The point is, sir, there were two flaws in that passport. The reason the number of it caused red lights to flick on was that 3 years ago another supposed Austrian bearing a passport with the same number was arrested in California by the FBI, and is now serving time in Soledad."
"Really? Good Lord. Not very clever of the Soviets, after all."
"I called up the FBI man here in London and asked what the charge had been. It appears the other agent was trying to blackmail an executive of the Intel Corporation in Silicon Valley into selling him secrets of technology."
"Very naughty."
"Nuclear technology."
"Which gave you the impression..."
"That Franz Winkler came into this country lit up like a neon sign, and the sign was a message.
a message on two legs. Sir Nigel's face was still wreathed in good humour, but some of the twinkle had faded from his eyes. And what did this remarkable message say, John?
I think it said, I cannot give you the executive illegal agent, because I do not know where he is. But follow this man. He will lead you to the transmitter. And he did. So I staked out the transmitter, and the agent came to it at last.
What exactly are you trying to say? Sir Nigel replaced his knife and fork on the empty plate and dabbed his mouth with his napkin.
I believe, sir, that the operation was blown. It seems to me unavoidable to conclude that someone on the other side deliberately blew it away.
What an extraordinary suggestion. Let me recommend the strawberry flan. I had some last week. Different batch, of course. Yes? Two, my dear, if you please. Yes, a little fresh cream.
May I ask a question? Said Preston, when the plates had been cleared.
I'm sure you will, anyway, smiled Sir Nigel.
Why did the Russian have to die?
As I understand, he was crawling towards a nuclear bomb with every apparent intention of detonating it.
I was there, said Preston, as the strawberry flan arrived. They waited until the cream had been poured.
The man was wounded in the thigh, stomach, and shoulder.
Captain Lyndhurst could have stopped him with a kick. There was no need to blow his head off.
I'm sure the good captain wished to make absolutely sure, suggested the master.
With the Russian alive, Sir Nigel, we would have had the Soviet Union banged to rights, caught in the act. Without him, we have nothing that cannot be convincingly denied. In other words, the whole thing now has to be suppressed forever.
How true, nodded the spymaster, masticating thoughtfully on a mouthful of shortcake, pastry, and strawberries.
Captain Lyndhurst happens to be the son of Lord Frinton.
Indeed, Frinton. Does one know him?
Apparently, you were at school together.
Really? There are so many. Hard to recall.
And I believe Julian Lyndhurst is your godson.
My dear John, you do check up on things, don't you now?
Sir Nigel had finished his dessert. He steepled his hands, placed his chin on his knuckles, and regarded the MI5 investigator steadily. The courtesy remained. The good humour was draining away.
Anything else?
Preston nodded gravely. An hour before the assault on the house went in, Captain Lyndhurst took a call in the hallway of the house across the road. I checked with my colleague, who first took the phone. The caller was ringing from a call box.
No doubt one of his colleagues.
No, sir. They were using radios, and no one outside that operation knew we were inside the house. None, that is, but a very few in London.
May I ask what you're suggesting? Just one more detail, Sir Nigel. Before he died, that Russian whispered one word. He seemed very determined to get that single word out before he went. I had my ear close to his mouth at the time. What he said was, Philby.
Philby? Good heavens, I wonder what he could have meant by that.
I think I know. I think he thought Harold Philby had betrayed him, and I believe he was right.
I see. And may I be privileged to know of your deductions? The chief's voice was soft, but his tone was devoid of all its earlier bonhomie.
Preston took a deep breath. I deduce that Philby the traitor was a party to this operation, possibly from the outset. If he was, he would have been in a no-lose situation. Like others, I have heard it whispered that he wants to return home, here to England, to spend his last days. If the plan had worked, he could probably have earned his release from his Soviet masters and his entry from a hard-left government in London, perhaps a year from now, or he could tell London the general outline of the plan, then betray it.
And which of these two remarkable choices do you suspect he made?
The second one, Sir Nigel.
To what end, pray?
To buy his ticket home, from this end. A trade.
And you think I would have been a party to that trade?
I don't know what to think, Sir Nigel. I don't know what else to think. There has been talk about his old colleagues, the magic circle, the solidarity of the establishment of which he was once a member, that sort of thing. Preston studied his plate with its half-eaten strawberries. Sir Nigel gazed at the ceiling for a long time, before letting out a profound sigh.
"You're a remarkable man, John. Tell me, what are you doing this day week?"
"Nothing, I believe." "Then please meet me at the door of Sentinel House at 8 in the morning. Bring your passport. And now, if you'll forgive me, I suggest we forgo coffee in the library." The man in the upper window of the safe house in the Geneva back street stood and watched the departure of his visitor. The head and shoulders of the guest appeared below him. The man walked down the short path to the front gate and stepped into the road where his car waited. The car's driver stepped out, came round the vehicle, and opened the door for the senior man. Then he walked back to the driver's door. Before he climbed back in, Preston raised his gaze to the figure behind the glass in the upper window. When he was behind the steering wheel, he asked, "That's him? That's really him? The man from Moscow?"
"Yes, that's him.
And now, the airport, if you please," replied Sir Nigel from the rear seat. They drove away.
"Well, John, I promised you an explanation," said Sir Nigel a few moments later. "Ask your questions."
Preston could see the face of the chief in his mirror. The older man was gazing out at the passing countryside. "The operation?"
"You're quite right. It was mounted personally by the General Secretary with the advice and assistance of Philby. It seems it was called Plan Aurora. It was betrayed, but not by Philby."
"Why was it blown away?" Sir Nigel thought for several minutes.
"From quite an early stage, I believed that you could be right, both in your tentative conclusions in what is now called the Preston Report of last December, and in your deductions after the intercept in Glasgow, even though Harcourt Smith declined to believe in either. I was not certain the two were linked, but I was not prepared to discount it. The more I looked at it, the more I became convinced that Plan Aurora was not a true KGB operation. It had not the hallmarks, the painstaking care. It looked like a hasty operation, mounted by a man or a group who distrusted the KGB. Yet there was little hope of your finding the agent in time."
"I was floundering in the dark, Sir Nigel, and I knew it. There were no patterns of Soviet couriers showing up on any of our immigration controls. Without Winkler, I'd never have got to Ipswich in time." They drove for several minutes in silence. Preston waited for the master to resume in his own time.
"So, I sent a message to Moscow," said Sir Nigel eventually.
"From yourself?"
"Good Lord, no. That would never have done, much too obvious. Through another source, one I hoped would be believed. It was not a very truthful message, I'm afraid. Sometimes one must tell untruths in our business, but it went through a channel I hoped would be believed."
"And it was?"
"Thankfully, yes. When Winkler arrived, I was sure the message had been received, understood, and above all, believed as true."
"Winkler was the reply?" asked Preston.
"Yes, poor man. He believed he was on a routine mission to check on the Greeks and their transmitter. By the by, he was found drowned in Prague 2 weeks ago. Knew too much, I suppose."
"And the Russian in Ipswich?"
"His name, I've just learned, was Piotrowski, a first-class professional and a patriot.
But he, too, had to die."
"John, it was a terrible decision, but unavoidable. The arrival of Winkler was an offer, a proposal for a trade-off. No formal agreement, of course, just a tacit understanding. The man, Piotrowski, could not be taken alive and interrogated. I had to go along with the unwritten and unspoken trade with the man in the window back there in the safe house.
If we had got Piotrowski alive, we'd have had the Soviet Union over a barrel."
"Yes, John, indeed we would. We could have subjected them to a huge international humiliation, and to what end? The USSR could not have taken it lying down. They'd have had to reply somewhere else in the world. What would you have wished? A return to the worst aspects of the Cold War?"
"It seems a pity to lose an opportunity to screw them, sir."
"John, they're big and armed and dangerous. The USSR is going to be there tomorrow and next week and next year. Somehow,
We have to share this planet with them. Better they be ruled by pragmatic and realistic men than hotheads and zealots.
And that merits a trade with men like the one in the window, Sir Nigel.
Sometimes it has to be done. I'm a professional, so is he. There are journalists and writers who would have it that we in our profession live in a dream world. In reality, it's the reverse. It is the politicians who dream their dreams, sometimes dangerous dreams, like the General Secretary's dream of changing the face of Europe as his personal monument. A top intelligence officer has to be harder-headed than the toughest businessman. One has to trim to the reality, John. When the dreams take command, one ends up with a Bay of Pigs. The first break in the Cuba missiles impasse was suggested by the KGB resident in New York. It was Khrushchev, not the professionals, who had gone over the top.